Anyways, it's 8:31, so it's time to welcome everybody to Torah Motion, the beginning of our winter semester, even though it's a continuation of the course. Dr. Mark Shapiro, a pleasure to have him back. Always interesting as we continue going through his book and of his letters to Rabbanim. So, Vakasha, welcome everybody to be a good year, a good secular year, a good year for everybody, a healthy year. Okay, Vakasha.
We're in part 32. We're two-thirds of the way done. So you've been with me so far. We'll take it to the end. Since Rabbi Kalman mentioned Rabbanit, you know, I had an epiphany that I raised the question why it's called Rabbanit. I'm not talking about today. When the Rebbetzins, they call them Rabbanit. And also I said the Chidah refers to like women rabbis as Rabbanit, women Talmidei Chachamim. So he's using a feminine. Why not Rabbah? Why? Because that Rabbah is what some of them pick today. And I had the epiphany that it comes, how do you say a righteous woman? Well, there's two ways to say it. One is Sadekes and one is Sadkanit. In fact, we talk about the Nushim Sadkanios. So it's obvious to me now. I didn't know, because I raised the question a number of classes ago, where did they get this idea of Rabbanit? I think it's parallel to Sadkanit. Strangely enough, I checked the Jastro, so you have Tzadikas. The poor of Tzadikas is Tzadikot. You would think there'd be a woman, a female Tzadika, but it's not. It's Tzadik, Tzadikas, or Tzadkanit. So I think Rabbanit is along the motto of Tzadkanit. So thank you, Rabbi Kelvin. Okay, a couple things before we get going. Oh, and I hope Mel's with us, because is Mel with us? Text me, Mel. If not, I'm going to hold off on this.
I'm with you.
Okay, Mel. Baruch Hashem. But before we get to that, I want to show you something here. It's relevant to what we spoke about last week. When I mentioned young Orthodox public intellectuals, and if I had more time, I'd play you something from one of my favorite public intellectuals, Glenn Lowry, speaking to one of my other favorite public intellectuals, John McWhorter of Columbia. And he gives his definition of what a public intellectual is and why Ibram Kendi, if you know the culture wars, why he is not. He's an empty suit, he calls him. He's not. But this Rabbi Ari Lam, I don't know if anyone knows him from the Lam family. He is grandson of Norman Lam. He is... also one of these young up-and-coming public intellectuals doing what Rabbi Sacks said to do, right? For, you know, I don't know if he's in the Wall Street Journal yet, but Newsweek, other things. So this appeared just 2 weeks ago when I just saw it randomly. And what I want to share with you and why it's relevant to what we were doing is he's talking about how the Beis Medrash, he quotes how with George Will, went to the YU, Yeshiva University based mentor. She said, how can anyone learn anything in here? There's too much noise. So he talks about the idea of rabbis and in the base medrash through arguing. And that's as long as you accept certain basic presumptions, there's nothing wrong with having strongly held opinions, etc. But then he says in the middle, he says, in talking about the Gemara, he says, one might imagine that discussions among such esteemed and holy rabbis would be conducted in hushed, respectful tones. Instead, the ancient sages cracked jokes, traded vicious puns, and insulted each other's appearances. And then he goes on with another example. So that's exactly what I mentioned, that all these insults and other things, when you look at it, you're like, why would they speak this way? But rabbis speaking to other rabbis, it's like a club. When we look in it, it's like strange because we're sort of on the outside looking in. That was at least my point. Okay, now you got to ring the bells here because it's correction time. And I always there's no embarrassment to making corrections, especially maybe if it was an area I'm expert in. But what I'm going to tell you now is something I'm just, there's a few experts, areas I guess I could say I'm sort of expert, but this is just derivative from what I've learned and what I've seen. And it's not my mistake. It's all the people. You can go online, you can see a lot of people. It's what I was always under the assumption. And I thank Howard Handler for this. And Mel raised the question about Adon Olam. You know, that Lachbira, that's what it should be. And I said, well, look at the rhyming. It's obviously Lachbira. And I played you the different renditions. of Adon Olam. Also, I showed you how in the first line it goes, and there's a name for this. This where you go unstressed, stressed, unstressed, stressed. Adon Olam. And then you get to Melech, so it has to be Melech. And so if you look around, the way I described it is exactly how it's described. That in fact, if you Google it, you'll see in the old Wikipedia before it was corrected that they give this example for this special type, I forget what they call it, of type of poetry where it's unstressed, unstressed, unstressed. They give that very line of Adon Olam. You can find all sorts of other examples. And you can also find exactly what I said, discussions of it, that it has to be the last syllable, even though it's from a grammatical standpoint, it's lachbira, not lachbira. Okay, now Howard, and based upon that, I said that this is an example like we see later with poets that even though the grammatical rule is one thing, they intend you to pronounce it the way I said. And as I said, that's not my idea. That's what's out there. And all the, well, thank you, Howard Handler. He points out to me, and Raymond Scheindlin, I don't know if it's Scheindlin or Shandlin, taught for many years at the seminary, an expert in Hebrew poetry. He takes up this issue and he says it's not true. He believes this is an anachronistic thing. You can see, and I thank you, Howard. Howard himself studied this years ago. You can find an essay of Scheindlin, A Guide to Golden Age Hebrew Prosody. He basically says as follows, what his point was, and I saw also in the Encyclopedia Judaica, because then I started investigating it, that the Spanish poets were not at all interested in rhyming the way I mentioned. And that comes later. As Scheindlin says, stress plays no role in rhyme. Thus, a stressed syllable may rhyme with an unstressed syllable. The point is that for the Spanish poets, the only thing that was important was the meter, yateid, tenua, etc. And that when you sing it, it has to be recited the way we do, because when you sing it, that's the way it has to be. But the idea that I said, that I expressed, and which I've seen, it's all out there. It's according to Professor Scheindlin and others, it's not true at all, that all they cared about was yateid and tenua, and therefore what I said was incorrect, that the poet did not intend you to intend it to be read as lach bira, rhyming, because for him the only thing that mattered was the meter. And I take Professor Scheindlin's, he's the expert, the real expert. Furthermore, then I looked back again at the Yehuda Alevi, and also it's in Rosh Hashanah Parchon, in his work, because they, what are they doing? They're criticizing all the people who, for the sake of poetry, are putting Mila'el, Mila'ra, all the things I mentioned. If you read it, you see, though, he's only referring to where for the point set, where for the meter, you add, let's say, an extra vav that then turns it Mila'el or Mila'ra. He's not referring to the rhyming. That will come about 200 years later. But it's not, it's so Mel, I correct myself, and I take back what I said, that it's obvious that the poet had to have that rhyme. And as I said, the funny thing is that when I Googled it, I found that in the old Wikipedia, they say this, but then you have these chats. I don't know if you ever noticed, Wikipedia, they have discussions, chats. And someone explains to the person who wrote this that, no, that this form of poetry you're speaking about, it's anachronistic. The Spanish poets didn't use it. They only used yateid tenua, and no one has yet corrected that. So there you go. So I'm thankful that I could correct that. We spoke about this sitter. Well, lo and behold, these classes are now having an impact on the next version of the Art Scroll sitter. I don't know how many people actually get it, how many shuls, but you'll see it. Why? Because I told you that in the bracha in the morning, it says, the Art Scroll sitter says, Shasali kol tzorki. And I said that, not the Art Scroll, the Koran, which is followed the vocalization in the RCA is exactly from Koran. And I said it should be Sha'asali called Sarki. So they put it, first of all, they looked at all the different Sidurim and they put it to the expert, Professor Richard Steiner, and he concludes that what I said is absolutely correct. So the next version of the RCA Siddur, it's Sha'asali. Because remember, Li, it's you push back, then the previous word, the syllable goes one back. Since I just gave a correction, gave credit for Art Scroll, let me tell you something. You know, I went with this, that the Art Scroll gets it wrong and Koren and RCA gets it right. In Kiddush, where is it? In Kiddush Friday night, we say, Kihu Yom Techila. What comes after that? Well, in the song, sort of quasi-song, we say, Lemikra'ei Kodesh. That's how Art Scroll has it. But Koren has it, Lemikra'ei Kodesh. Now this one, it's not so problematic here. It's time to figure this out. All you have to do is look here in the Chumash. There you go. Look in Pas Perek Chaf Gimel there, Pasuk Beis. It says it explicitly, Mikra'ei Kodesh. And then look down, Pasuk Dalet, Egel Medo Miladei Hashem, Mikra'ei Kodesh. Now, so why isn't it? Why is it it's not with Nasoga Har? Why? Because Kodesh, the accent's on the first syllable. So you would expect the previous word to be Mikrai, like Artsro has it. Well, that's it's an exception, and people have offered reasons why there's an exception there. The olive could be swallowed, whatever. But whatever it is, we see clearly that Koren is right, and RCA is right, and we can get into this if you want. Maybe next class I'll talk about Hamotzi or Hamotzi, because they got another big machlokas there. Is it Hamotzi Lachem in Haaretz or Hamotzi Lachem in Haaretz? And it's not Israelis versus Americans, because you, again, Lechem, first syllable, so then you'd expect Nasoga Chor in the previous one. The last thing I want to do before we begin is we created a lot of questions about the Der Yassin situation. Before I do that, though, just let me show you a few things on your own you can look at. I mentioned Bosnian SS troops. By mistake, I said Serb officers. It's Croats. You can, for instance, look at your whole big article here in the Wikipedia. This is called the Hanchar Division. These are Croatian officers, Bosnian Muslim fighting on the side of the Nazis. Here you have a picture of there's the Mufti. He raised these SS soldiers among the Muslim population. You can also, as I found another article on, this is another division of the SS, also Bosnian Muslims. Here, German officers and Bosnian Muslim soldiers. The other thing I wanted to show you is, if you look in the, we spoke about the Irgun. If you look at the terrorist attacks in the 30s, you have all sorts of things that I'm not prepared to defend. For example, bombs thrown into crowded marketplaces, bombs detonated in buses. This is the exact sort of thing that the rabbis were very opposed to. If you start from the during the insurgency, then you notice they're all attacks on soldiers. You have the incident I mentioned last class, the sergeant affair, where in response to Jews being executed for their underground activities, they executed two sergeants, which, by the way, led to five Jews being killed by British policemen taking revenge. This is a different sort of, you know, they thought they were fighting a battle to free Israel from imperialists, which explains, by the way, why they were interested in allying with the Soviet Union. Over Shabbos, I finished up Heller's book on Lechi. And let me just read to you, page 347. This is a letter from Eldad, in which he writes in 1948. He says, Eldad was one of the leaders of him and Yellen of Lechi. He says, there is no doubt that there will be a world war between the USSR and the USA and Britain. We shall fight on the side of the USSR. So that's Lechi. That's not Irgun. I already mentioned that for Lechi, the most important thing was freeing the land of Israel. And they were prepared even to ally with the Nazis if the Nazis would stop their extermination of the Jews and would help them free the land of Israel. But if you do go further, during the war, its civil war itself, you do have examples again of bombs that the Damascus Gate, at the cinema, etc. I'll leave it for other people to discuss the morality of this. What I do want to mention, however, is the Gerasene situation, because I don't know if the word I use, massacre, which is the word you often use, is the correct word. No one was ever taken out and shot up against the wall, things like that. But I think, you know, if innocents were killed, I guess you can call it a massacre. So did it happen or not? The number in Deir Yassin is 115. You have two different versions of what happened here. Now, first of all, understand the Israeli government, or the proto-government, the Jewish Agency, and the Haganah, they acknowledged that there were innocents killed, and they sent a letter of apology, etc. So normally people would say that's an acknowledgement by the government. It's a little more problematic for the defenders of the other side, in that the claim could be made that they were very interested in getting rid of the Irgun and having them discredited. So attributing to them a massacre, which they didn't take part of, would serve those purposes. Incidentally, the number you might hear of 250 people killed, that's a phony number, but that's the Irgun number. The Irgun wanted to make it seem as if they want to scare the Arabs and say they killed all these people. So a couple of you emailed me, and that there's been two books that have challenged this. One is by Uri Milstein, and the other is Eliezer Tauber. Yes, they all acknowledge that innocents were killed, but in what context were innocents killed? Their argument is that these were all in houses, and to get into the houses, they threw hand grenades and things like that. So they were all killed in that way. Although Eliezer Tauber does say, he says as follows, in the heat, that the only example he thinks of innocents being killed was this one family that came out with their hands raised, and an individual Irgun fighter shot at them, killing 11, and he did this, in his mind, for revenge. But other than that, there were no examples. So look, at the end, as I said, I don't know. I'm not an expert in this. This is a debate between people like Uri Milstein, who's a renowned and important historian of the War of Independence. He's not some orthodox type person trying to put forth a position. He's a real historian, and he totally rejects this. On the other hand, Benny Morris, who's done important work, he thinks differently. Everyone acknowledges there were war crimes. There's no question there were war crimes, but we're not, if an individual killed here or a woman raped, we're not talking about that. We're talking about more, more people were killed. So the point I wanted to make, though, is that I don't care. Really, it's not really important for my purposes. What I was saying is that, number one, you don't discredit Zionism based on that. If you have soldiers who behave improperly, and remember, I was responding to our anti-Zionist person who was saying, here, you and your state, look what it did. I mean, I can go down the list of the Arab massacres. What about, do you know what happened when going up to the Hebrew University? What was it, 70, 80 people killed, including Professor Freiman, who was the editor of the Tshuva Tarambam? They were simply, how many times Jews were just stopped and massacred like that? I can go down a very, very long list. So the fact that, let's assume it did happen, for the sake of argument, it doesn't discredit. It's not an original sin. It's not, it's people doing the wrong thing. And my other point is that we shouldn't be afraid of the truth. If this thing can never be proven one way or the other, then it remains a dispute, teku, as we would say. But if it's true, and if it is, this is, we should be able to look in Tanakh. You see, Jews in the days of Tanakh did bad things. If Jews can do bad things too, it doesn't, we can accept that and understand, know that we're pained by this, if it did happen. And we're bothered by this. We don't celebrate this. We don't like this. We don't want this. And I have to say, I think that makes us different than the other side, which celebrate these sorts of things. But so, is it authentic? Did it happen or not? Again, leave it to Milstein and Benny Morris. Benny Morris, by the way, he is the one who uncovered, based on government documents, that Israel actually expelled many Arabs. Contrary to what we were told growing up, that they all left on their own because they were told by the Arab governments. And Morris claims that they should have expelled more, because then there would have been an end to this whole problem, because the two populations would have been. So normally you think of people denying the expulsions for political reasons. Benny Morris argues basically, well, I don't think it's an argument anymore. I mean, it's factual based on government documents. This is the Haganah we're talking about now. And he says that the mistake of Ben-Gurion was not expelling war riders because in a wartime, this is the fifth column, and these things happen. And then you have to look at the larger picture. So it's not like Benny Morris is some bleeding heart liberal here arguing when he talks about Deir Yassin. So let's leave that. Let us now pick up on where we are. As I said, we are about two-thirds of the way done. We're picking up Siman Kuf Yod Tes, number 119, page Resh Mem Zion. And the question I had, and this went, we're going to be introduced to some new people soon, but to Reb Chaim Rappaport is as follows. The Tanya, the question about the Tanya, both about a textual matter and an ideological sort of position. I want to show you what appears in the Tanya. I don't know if we have any people here who learned Tanya. Anyone who spent any time in Chabad, of course, this is their major text. It's been published basically every place on earth where, I don't know what that means when they talk about publishing like in the North Pole or if they did go there, I don't know. I don't know how you publish, how you set up. Maybe they publish two. They set up a portable printer. I don't know what they do, but in the end of the Tanya, you have something called Igeret HaKodesh and from the Baal HaTanya, or Shneur Zalman of Ladi. And I want to read you something that he says here in section 22. He says, an open rebuke out of a love concealed. Come now and let us adjudge. Remember the days of old. Consider the years of every generation. Has such ever happened since the days of the world? And where you have found such a custom in any one of the books of the earlier and latter sages of Israel, that it should be usage and regulation to ask for advice in mundane matters? He's saying he was asked a question like, well, what type of house should I buy or something like that. And the Baal HaTanya says, who ever heard of such a practice that you ask the rabbi a question like this in mundane matters? Such was not asked even of the greatest of the sages of Israel at the time of Amorim. You never would. The only people you would ask things like this about is maybe you've had a real prophet. So he says, the Baal HaTanya says, we don't have this concept of asking questions of great rabbis. So already you see this is very much at odds with what you think of Hasidim today. Hasidim today, including Lubavitchers, who would go to the Rebbe, ask about everything. Should I take a new job? Should I go to the university? The Lubavitcher Rebbe, I knew someone who the Lubavitcher Rebbe, I was in Brandeis with him. I was a student and he was a student with me. The Lubavitcher Rebbe told him to go to university and told him, I guess he told him to go to Brandeis too. I don't remember if he did, but he told him to go to university. So I'm assuming he asked him which university. This was a guy, he's a Baal Tshuva. He was a Russian and he was very good at mathematics. So the Rebbe would give different answers to different people. But they would ask the Rebbe everything. And in the Hasidic world, you can't get married, of course, unless you get approval from the Rebbe and all sorts of things. So here you see, maybe marriage is not mundane, but in terms of jobs, in terms of all sorts of stuff, you see the Baal HaTanya giving a very different perspective. Now that's not what the question I asked, although this is important because this text is always cited. Maybe if you have some Chabadniks, they can say, well, you have to read it differently, but this text is always cited as showing how things are different today than in the past when the Baal HaTanya, and I'll read you a mezuzah in a second. My question was as follows, that if you go to the Hebrew, it says as follows, he says, beginning line 4, he says, where did you find Minhag Zeh, Be'echa Mikol Sifrei Chachmei Yisrael Rishon V'Achronim? Where did you find such a practice in all the Jewish holy books? Leos Minhag V'Tikun Lishol Be'etza Gashmus, Kadas Malasos. I go back and forth, Svartakashanazah, I can't keep track. He says, where do you find in all the holy writings that there's a Minhag V'Tikun to ask advice of great rabbis what to do if it's, you know, mundane matters? Om Hagashmi. Om Hagashmi means, you know, I want to get a new house. Should I buy it here or here? Or should I get a four-bedroom house or a two-bedroom house, etc.? Well, what about this word, Minhag V'Tikun? So if you look at the English translation, he translates it as usage and regulation. I don't know if you read it, it's obvious. If you know rabbinic Hebrew, it should be min ha-vatikin. Vasikin. Now, well, we have this phrase that vasikin, they refer to the pious people, the pious of old in particular. That's where we get the expression daven vasikin. And you have the expression minhag vasikin all over rabbinic literature. That is, you have minhag of the hamonam, which often the rabbis tried to get rid of. But then if they think that it's a minhag of good standing, where even if it's problematic, but the earlier rabbis vouched for it or established it, then they always say, well, this is a minhag vasikin, so we can keep this minhag. So if you read it here, it seems to me, at least I thought it should be clear, that it says, where did you find, because Sifrei Chachmei Yisrael harishonim v'achronim liyos minhag vasikin? Where do we find it? This is, you know, an authoritative type of minhag. So I asked Rabbi Chaim Rappaport, we spoke about it in the picture again. What's going on here? Is this a printing error in the Tanya? This is the Tanya that every single person uses. They reprint over and over again. So he writes to me and he says that I'm not the first person to suggest this. The Kloisenberger Rebbe also quoted it and changed it to Vasikin. We're going to deal with the Kloisenberger Rebbe in a couple of classes. But then he points out that in the first printing of this letter, it does say minhag vasikin. So it seems apparently that there's a that in all the standard tanyas now, including the one they just translated, it's a mistake, or at least there's a good possibility it's a mistake, because the Lubavitch authorities, they know about this, but they still they changed it. I'm really not sure, but Rabbi Rappaport thinks it's a mistake. A few weeks ago, in Rabbi Mazuz, we know Rabbi Mazuz. We'll come back to Rabbi Mazuz in a couple weeks again, or a few weeks. But in number 239, I think that's 4 weeks ago, his weekly Torah newsletter, lo and behold, he deals with this very same passage. And I'll read you what he says. He says, this is on section 9. He speaks about how the Tanya is printed every single place, everywhere. And then he mentions this letter. And he quotes this letter, which I just quoted you from the Bala Tanya. And he says, after quoting, who ever heard of such a thing that you ask the great rabbis about matters of gashmius, mundane matters? And he says, Hayom kulam yodim etzei. He says, today everyone knows this. What do you mean? No, he says, today everyone knows. It says, everyone knows the opposite, that you do go to the rabbis. And he gives the example. If you have a Mishiyesh Leizabaya, he's an Asek, he's a slur. If you have a problem, if you have a business question, etc., or if there's someone who's ill, you go to the rabbi who blesses you and gives you advice. You have people in the Haredi world who won't take the vaccine unless they go ask the rabbi. What does the rabbi know about the vaccine? Since when is the rabbi an expert in medicine that you're supposed to ask him? There's the Dayan from Brooklyn who listens to the show. He was shocked because you now have people going to the modern Orthodox rabbis. And you have I don't know if they're asking, but you have the modern Orthodox rabbis, Schechter and the others. They're out there saying you should take the vaccine. And he's astounded by this. He comes from a Hasidic world. Because what? Us in the modern Orthodox world, we care whether the rabbi says take the vaccine or not? Rav Schechter himself says you have to do what the doctors say, but the whole concept that we put a rabbi up to tell us, at least in what people I know, that they care what the doctors say. They're not deciding one way or the other based upon even a Gadol Yisrael like Rav Schechter. So it's sort of like bleeding maybe from the Haredi world, but in the Haredi world, you need it. The ministers of health in Israel, they need to go to Bnei Brak. They need to get the Gadol, and they need to get Rav Kanievsky to announce you have to take the vaccine. It's astounding, but that's the way it is. So Rav Mazuz said, he says, but in the days of the Bala Tanya, this was a new thing, it seems, because the Bala Tanya doesn't understand. What are you asking me a question about Gashmius? Amar ein davar kaseh b'olam. The Bala Tanya says there's no such concept. Lo hayam mina kaseh v'shol ma lasot. Al tishalim. The Bala Tanya is saying there's no such minhag and don't ask. And then he says, and what it says in the letter, minhag v'tikun, this is not the tikkun, it should be minhag vatikin. And then he goes on, and he says at the end, he says, I recently saw in a chuveret, that's like a little booklet, Nin Meli Itzchayim in America, He says, I recently saw in a pamphlet, Eitz Chaim from America, that someone pointed this out. There is no Eitz Chaim American journal. Well, that's not true, actually, Bubov. But that's not where he saw this. He saw this in this book. How do I know this? Because he sent me 4 pages of notes, Haros, and one of the notes is on this letter of Rabbi Bapport, in which he said, I too agree that it should be Vasikin. So I believe he's just forgetting. Now, in the note here, Rabbi Mazuz says, he gives a story, an example. He says once they woke up, he says, these people go and ask the rabbi everything. He goes, sometimes they really go crazy. Once they woke up, Rav Ben Zion Abashal. Rav Ben Zion Abashal was from Porat Yosef Yeshiva, big Sephardic rabbi, in the middle of the night at 3 a.m. And he said to them, what do you want? And he said, tomorrow I have... he must have heard this from Ben Shaul. Tomorrow I have a bris of my grandson. Which color sweater should I bring to him for to dress the grandson in? You know, what he wants to know is Segula, what type of sweater should he dress the child who's going to have the bris in? So the rabbi said to him, the color of a sweater, why is that important? And he says, well, there's a dispute between me and my wife. That is between this grandma and grandpa. Saban Sapta, what the child should wear. So they go into the rabbi to ask him what to do. One of them says it should be yellow, and the other says it should be white. What should we do? And Rabbi Ben Zion Abashal says to them, Bishvil zet, because of this, you woke me up. And the man said to him, I thought that you don't sleep, you're like an angel. You don't sleep. And then Rav Mazuz says, Eza tipshut, Eza sikhlut, Eza baru, what idiocy. And then he says, it's good sometimes that your phone is off, or that no one knows your phone number, so they don't drive you crazy. Mahatir fazeh. What is this craziness? And this, he says, is what the Baal HaTanya is complaining about, that people were starting this nonsense, that every little thing you need to ask the rabbi what sweater you're going to wear, because he's supposed to decide, work it out with your wife. That's why you're married. You don't need to go to the rabbi to decide what sweater to wear. So that's the Siman, and it's just Hashkacha Pratis that... We came, that Rav Mazuz happened to speak about it. If we didn't have all these tangents, we probably would have spoke about it the same week that he dealt with it. So is that just random? Nothing in this world is random, according to some Rishon. Okay, on to Simon Kuf Chof. And the title of this is called, we're back to Rav Avinir. Rav Avinir, one of the leading rabbis of the Chardal world in the Kav, the right-wing religious Zionist world, but of the Mamachtiyot type, the real connection to the state, can do no wrong type of, I don't know how else to describe it, but a very influential Rav Avinir, one of the most influential of the Chardali rabbis in both camps, lives in Beit El. Incidentally, they say he doesn't get along with the other side of Beit El has Rabbi Zalman Muhammad, also Chardal, but from the other side of the Chardal, and apparently they don't get along. But if my son and daughter, right before the lockdown, had a tour, if any of you go to Israel when we're able to, you want to get the best tour of the old city, it's by Rabbi Yechiel. Here, let me show you a picture of this. He's a good friend of mine, and if you want a tour, hold on. Let me just tell you about him for a second and why I'm mentioning. You can also. Okay. Oh, let me get you on here. Maybe some of you have even heard him in lectures. Rabbi Yechiel Goldhaber. This is Rabbi Yechiel Goldhaber. And he's a Karlin Stolen Chassid. He's an expert in so many areas, and one of the areas he's an expert in is the Yishuv HaYashav, the old community of Eretz Yisrael and Jerusalem. So he gives these tours of the old city, I had it, and I paid for my son and a few yeshiva friends and my daughter, and they went on the tour. And one of the places they go to is the yeshiva Rav Avinair. Used to be at Teret Konim, now they call it Teret Yerushalayim. It's in the Muslim quarter of the old city. But I told the boys to wear their baseball hats, and although walking with Yechiel Goldhaber, it doesn't. I don't know. But if you've never been, if you've never seen the Kotel Katan, there's a section of the Kotel Maravi, which is in the Muslim quarter, which people don't know about. It's the actual Kotel, except we see it on the left side. It doesn't end there. It continues and it picks up. I remember when I was in Israel once in the summer on Tisha B'Av, people go there. But if you want to take your tour with Rabbi Yechiel, he gave the Mormons a tour last year. Of course, obviously, the tour he gave the Mormons will be, he's not talking about Rav Shmuel Salant and other things and showing them the yeshivas, but he's really something else. So Rav Avinair's yeshivas in the Muslim quarter, at Teret Yerushalayim, and that was one of the places they visited. The question I asked Rav Avinair is as follows. I don't want to get into really, he's quoting Rav Kook. I don't want to get, it's about Adam HaRishon. And in his book, he quotes Rav Kook that the prophecy of Adam HaRishon was above that of Moshe Rabbeinu. So I don't want to get into Rav Kook, is it, how he understands Adam HaRishon. Is this a historical person that we're reading stories about? Is this an archetype? Wait to the new book and you'll see. But the idea that he says that anyone's prophecy can be greater than Moshe, I said, it's very problematic. The Rambam's seventh principle, this is his Ikar, that no prophet either before Moshe or after Moshe would be greater than him. And that means, for instance, that you can't have Muhammad come in and say, well, he's greater than Moshe or anything like that. There's disagreement with the Rambam. Some speak of the Mashiach as being greater than Moshe Rabbeinu. But that's the Rambam's principle. What he says as follows is a very short note, but Adam HaRishon is not included in history. He's before history. He's outside of what we regard as history. He's the Shoresh of everyone. And there's a passage, and it's a famous Kabbalistic idea called the Zira Ilad Adam HaRishon, the special shine, as it were, of Adam HaRishon. So he's sort of... I don't want to get into Kabbalistic things, Ainli Yasek Benistar, as the expression goes. I don't know about Kabbalistic stuff, or what I do know. I might read stuff, but I don't really know it. But there's some concept of Adam HaRishon as being like encompassing all of humanity, which again, this is going to be part of the issue of, as an archetype and, what is the serpent? Is this the Satan? All these sorts of things that, I'll deal with in the book, but this I thought it's an interesting concept that history doesn't begin in the primeval, it begins later. So when the Rambam speaks, according to Rav Kook at least, speaks about prophets, he's not referring to first man. Okay, just a small point. The next point, though, is a big one, and that's another letter to Rav Avinair. And I can't remember why I wrote to Rav Avinair. This is the last of the letters to Rav Avinair. I think I wrote to him, if I recall, because he has this idea, which I don't buy at all. And it shows that the Chardalim are really quite fundamentalist, even more often than the Charedim. In fact, soon we're going to see something by our friend Rabbi Yileib, which is puzzled in the eyes of Rav Avinair, and he's coming from the Charedi world. Rav Avinair, when I say fundamentalist in a sense, that to the point that he refuses to acknowledge that a Rishon, maybe even an Achron, I don't know, could be influenced by his environment to come up with ideas. I mentioned this example already because he was asked about a Barbanel shocking idea that only men are created B'Tselem Elohim, not women, because of success, men, because men's job is to understand matters intellectually. And that's not the job of women, and they don't have that ability. And so someone raised the point, which appears perfectly logical to me, that he was influenced here by Christian views about women, etc. I don't see why that's a problem, but Rav Avinair won't say that. He says, no, we say we don't accept the Abarbanel. but we will never say that he was influenced by non-Jewish ideas. He came to this idea through his reading of Torah. It's Torah. We just don't accept it. And we have a different approach. I don't know why. I know for a fact Rav Soloveitchik, who didn't think very highly of the Abarbanel, I do think highly of him, but I know Rav Soloveitchik wouldn't have that opinion about the Abarbanel. Maybe Bali Tosfos, but not the Abarbanel. But so Rav Aviner, so I want to give an example of something to Rav Aviner, that what he would say about this. If you're going to say that everything derives from Torah sources, then what about what I'm going to throw you now? What I'm going to throw you out now, and I'm going to show you inside. This really fits in with what we spoke about last week as well, about the Rambam and different truths for different people. What I'm going to show you now, no rabbi would ever mention from the pulpit. And for good reason. And I don't think most rabbis, even in a shiur, would mention it, because it's problematic and it raises questions. I don't have the answers to the questions. We'll try to work through the answer or possible approaches now. But first, you need to be shocked a bit with what I'm going to show you. And then we're going to hear a very interesting explanation from Rabbi Yehuda. Let me get it handy. He even wrote it up in I don't know if you can see it here. He wrote it up in Hebrew. In Hebrew, when he publishes his Chidushim, on, he's already published a number of Svarim, but when he publishes his Chidushim on Torah, he can perhaps include it in there. Look, I'm honored already that the Mechaber Sefer Svarim of such really valuable works is listening to us. But let me pull you up something. You're going to look at it, and then I'll read you my question to Rabbi Aviner. Okay, this is the tour. Actually, I don't want you to see this yet, because let me just tell you something about the tour. We have Yaakov ben Asher is an important medieval authority, the son of the great Rush. His father comes from Germany, he comes to Spain, the Arbaturim. So that's where, by the order of the Shulchan Aruch comes from, Orachayim, Choshen Mishmat, Yerodea, and Eben Ezer. It comes out of the Torah. He also wrote commentary on Chumash. We're familiar with it because if you read the Mikros Gedolos, you have the Balaturim. Balaturim is great. You get the Gematrias and all sorts of interesting stuff he points out to you, like Remez. Torah has this four parts to Torah. You have the Pshat, you have the Drash, you have the Remez, and the Sod. Many people assumed for a long time that this is it, that the great Balaturim, who wrote such important halachic works, that he spent all his time with gematrias and things when he learned Chumash. But that's just what happened, is when he wrote a long commentary. And the printers, however, they just pulled out those, what he called, these are like the spices. And so that's what everyone knows about the gematrias, and not just gematrias, the first letter and the last letter of words. He finds all the remnants. But he also wrote a Perush on Torah. And it was published in the 19th century and then recently reprinted in a nice good edition. They call it the Perush HaTorah Aruch. So it's a regular commentary, just like all the great Rishonim. He wrote a commentary on Chumash. So I want to read you something here. I'll show you something. This is in the story with Leah. And we all know the story that Yaakov married Leah. Let me first show you the pasuk he's commenting on. Let's see, what parak are we? Chaftes. Okay, Lamed. Sorry, Lamed. Is this where the page I need? Oh, no, Chaftes. Okay, so it says that, you know the story, how he was supposed to marry Rachel, and he said he married Leah. Now, in Pasuk Lamed Aleph, it says that God saw that Leah was hated, and he opened up her womb. And then look in verse 32. It says, Leah conceived and bore a son and called his name Reuven. What did she say, Kamara? Ki ra'a Hashem b'anyi. God has looked upon my affliction. And then, and now she says, my husband will love me. In the next pasuk, it says that she conceived again and she had a son. And what does it say? Ki shama Hashem, God has heard. Ki snua anochi, because I'm hated. He's therefore giving me another son. So let's look at what the Torah says here. Hirasha Mani, God has seen my affliction. It says, Beruven Amar, regarding Ruven, it says, he saw, and with Shimon, he heard. God heard her affliction. With Shimon, Ruven, he saw. Why? Lafisham, at the beginning, Kodim Shinoad Ruven, before Ruven was born, Hayamakaba, Yaakov would hit her, beat her. Umi Shinoad Nimnamalakosa. And once Ruven was born, Yaakov stopped hitting her. And that's why the Alkain Amra Kira, that's, when he was hitting her, that's what it means. God saw this and therefore gave her the child, Ruven, and he stopped. But he still would, Mekantra Bedvarim, he still would speak badly to her, rebuke her, etc. And when Shimon was born, Nimnagamize, he stopped this. And that's why it says that by Shimon that God heard, because he wasn't beating her anymore. He was only saying bad things to her. So it says God heard her affliction. Before, if you remember, before it says God saw my affliction. And now it says God heard that I'm hated. He heard because he heard Yaakov saying all these terrible things to me. And then it's, but he still wouldn't have relations with her until she had leave. So how can you say, I don't mean to be disrespectful about Yaakov ben Asher, how can you say this about Yaakov Avinu, that he would hit his wife? It's shocking. I actually, contrary to Rabbi Yalev, I like his pshat, which I'll read you in a minute, but this must be some midrash. I can't imagine a Rishon making this up. To me, it has to be and people were troubled by this, because the first printing of the Torah, this was left out. If you read my book, you get the details. They didn't include this because in the 19th century, this is too shocking, but it's in all the manuscripts. And now it's in the new editions. I think this has to be some Midrashic text. No one would come up with this on their own. It's interesting that a similar type of passage from the Rosh is found in the standard Baal Turim commentary. The Pasuk says, let me show you the Pasuk. A little different, actually. This goes the other direction. Who's doing the hitting? But look in Pasuk. This is Parag Gimel, Pasuk Yud Beis. God says, the man said, "The woman you gave to be with me, she gave me of the tree, and I did eat." In Hebrew, it's he nasonal li min ha'etz. It doesn't say she gave me of the fruit of the tree. She gave me of the tree. So the Baal Turim says there that Chava took a branch of the tree and kept hitting me with it until I agreed to eat the fruit. Okay, this, by the way, though, is not unique to the Baal Turim. It's found in numerous other passages. But what to do with this passage? So I asked this to Rav Avinir. Before reading you what Rav Avinir said, though, I want to read you Rav Yalev, our Talmud Chacham in residence, or one of, we have a number of Talmud Chacham in residence, writes, because I think you'll probably find it surprising also, perhaps. I mean, he begins very Tamui Meod. This is very strange, because we know, we've seen it throughout Chazal, and we receive from Rabbi Seinu Zal how great the Avos were, especially Yaakov, and how could he do something like this? But he says as follows. Chokrei Divrei Yemos Olam, Shabiz Manenu. He says, modern scholars have written about that it was accepted in medieval times among the non-Jews that the husband, in order to, quote, educate his wife, just like he has to educate his son, just like the son, the father would occasionally hit a child. I mean, I think parents still do that, unless the new parenting has conquered the world. So too, it was thought by many medievals in the Christian world that the husband has to do this to the wife as well. Not lo mitoch kas, not because of anger. Just because it's a toelet. And then he says, Uchayadua shetarbus agoyim mashpia gam al tarbus ayehudim, shenim tzai metocham. He says that the culture of the non-Jews influenced the culture of the Jews. In other words, in that time where the Torah was living in Spain, it was thought that this is how you train a woman. Not because you hate her or because you're punishing her, this to keep her in line. So therefore the Torah also did this. And he thought that it's possible to explain that Yaakov occasionally would hit his wife, Rak Mishum Tocha V'chinuch, only, I guess, to rebuke her and give her a chinuch. And this is, and he thought this is not a Maisa Shafel, but this is Maisa Meshubach. And he sent me, they've sent me an article or a summary of a lecture in which you have various medieval scholars here. It's called Spare the Rod, Spoil the Bride. And it's all about how the Christian's loving Christian husband's duty is to maintain order. And a man may, he quotes one of the medieval law codes, a man may chastise his wife and beat her for her own correction, for she is of his household, etc., etc. And so Rabbi Leib says that this is his explanation, which Rav Avinair would not accept, that this is, in those days, this was thought to be acceptable, and therefore, for the Torah, it makes sense that he would give such a drasha about, I think this probably goes back to earlier, but let's say he drew, like Rabbi Leib thinks he derived it himself, because this is in line with contemporary mores. And all the passages on Hazal that speak about how terrible it is to hit a wife and all these things, that's not referring to like to correct her from her bad actions. It's referring to, you know, just bad people who just lose their tempers and things like this. Not, no different than a child, though, you know, you could, some people go crazy and they hit their child, they have to have the children taken away from them. Others do it carefully organized, you know, a punch when they feel it's needed. So, and that's, and especially in those days, the women were often viewed as like children because they had no education, etc. So that's what Rabbi Leib says, but it's still a shocking. You tell this to people, you show this to people, they won't know what to make of this. How could, even Rabbi Leib gives the best possible explanation I think you can. Rav Avinair didn't give this explanation. I asked Rav Avinair as follows. Again, I knew he couldn't come up with that sort of explanation, which is makes sense to me. I said, how can we explain to people in our day and age what the Torah says? I say that these words that he says by Yaakov, enam mitkablim alev b'nei zmanenu, don't really work for contemporaries. Velorak zmanenu, not just people today. Already, as I told you, 150 years ago, they censored this out. Rav Avinair is stumped. Ani lo choshev she'efshar lever l'anashim, says, I don't think we can explain it. And then he gives in parentheses, he gives, I mean, he says, kasa leha. I mean, he says he was angry at her because she forced him to be married with her. I mean, what's he, I mean, he offers that like in parentheses, like, is that, I think he's trying to say, like, that's the best we could say, perhaps, and it doesn't, that's not going to solve the problem. So he doesn't have an answer. And this is a sort of passage that I think it bears in mind what Reb Yaakov Kapel Schwartz said. That, and he said it about Chazal, so Kavach Homer about Rishonim. Leave aside the explanation of Rabbi Leib, which I hadn't thought of until he sent it to me about a week ago. Rav Kapel Schwartz said that there are certain passages that we just say, well, we don't accept it. It's not ours. That's how I looked at it. Before I saw Rabbi Leib's understanding, you know, rabbinic literature is full of all sorts of things. We saw the passage about the man, the grandson says, I'm not going to help you, Grandpa. I'm not obligated to keep it all the aim. So Rav Yaakov Kapel Schwartz says, fine, we don't accept that as a way to lead our life. What is he saying by that? Because we have all the other passages that say otherwise. It's not, we're not rejecting it because it doesn't fit in with our morality. We have a Torah morality, and this is sort of not in line with it. So it's like one of these out-of-the-way, unusual passages. We don't have to answer for every passage. And I always think when you see passages like that, it's the same thing, that it's, these are just, they're outliers, they're unusual, and I don't feel that we need to explain every passage. Sometimes you can simply say, well, we don't accept that. That's not the way we look at it. Again, we can't be anachronistic. You know, in this country, in America, there's all this anachronism now. They have to judge people who lived 200 years ago. So even Abraham Lincoln, all the great things he did, because he didn't have a 21st century view of of men and women, of whites and blacks, and all of a sudden he's canceled, he's out. You got to be realistic here in how generations have changed and people think differently. Nevertheless, there will be times when I think you'll say that, yes, the Torah said it. Of course, we love the Torah. We look up to it. We honor the Torah. But not everything the Torah says is halacha l'doros. And I think we can say that, and even Rabbi Leib, I think, is saying, would agree to this. He doesn't think that today you're gonna do this. In those days, in that time, though, that was what was done. And we do believe that we've advanced beyond this. It's not that we think it's just a different culture, that in their days it was okay, and today it's not okay. But no, I think we all agree that it wasn't right then either, just like it wasn't right to have slaves in the 1800s. But those people had a different perspective. So, you know, you can't really judge people. You know, they were convinced that this is how you do things. Machiavelli has a passage in which he says that the way to get people just to learn in school is to humiliate them. Because they'll be so humiliated. And if anyone's heard stories about certain great Rosh Yeshiva, including our favorite, the way in the 40s and 50s when they would rebuke people, that was a method of learning. Today, we would never do it. And I don't know if we wouldn't do it just because we think it wouldn't work for us. I think we think it doesn't, you know, it might work for some people, but the average person, this isn't the way to, I think we recognize that's not the way to educate. So I think that's the thing. Passages like I just saw with the tour and passages in the Rambam. And I even spoke to a well-known Haredi Rav. Every person basically listening to us now would know the name of this rabbi, but I didn't ask him if I could say it, so I don't want to say. But I gave him one of these sort of passages, not the Torah, but another one. And he says, what's the problem? You don't accept that. And I said, well, I probed further. I said, so you think that our morality is different? He says, I have no problem saying that we have a different approach to this. I said, would you say this publicly? He said, no, I wouldn't say it like that. He said, it has to be phrased in a certain way. But he says, we approach matters differently, or we view as incorrect. The Rishonim could have a different view. But here's an example of where you have these hard passages, these troubling passages, which in yeshivas, we all struggle with them. I don't think it's such a struggle. Once you recognize that we're more, let's say, and Rav Kook sees this as part of the move to the Messianic era, that we're more, for example, we're more sensitive to certain matters of human rights and, you know, slavery. None of us can imagine having slaves or anything like that. But 300 years ago, who thought of it? This is 400 years ago. That's just the way the world is. Aristotle said that some people are just born into slavery. So how is it that we today are more sensitive to things that others weren't in the past? We're not greater than them. Or Rav Kook develops the idea that as we get closer to the Messianic era, more and more holy sparks are let go, so that in certain areas, we actually are moving in the direction of a more refined sense, because when the Mashiach comes, that's where we need to be. Doesn't mean we're better than the people in the past, but we're in a circumstance and we're standing on top of them. We're the midgets on top of the giants here. So Rav Kook explains very well how is it that people in our day and age seem to have these more sensitive approaches that previous generations did, including non-Jews, which is a problem, because don't the generations of Kites and Sinai, or of Cook's explanation, which is very Kabbalistic, that explains it. If you don't adopt this explanation, then you have a problem, because how do you explain when you see passages, let's say in the Achronim, which strike you as just, they don't work with your ethics, and you can't tell someone, well, your ethics are not Torah ethics, because your ethics are coming from Torah in many areas. And but so I think Rav Kook's, well, wait to the book of Eretz Hashem, you'll see Rav Kook's is this point explicated. I see it's already 9:29. Next week I'll introduce you to a couple new figures, including this individual, who unfortunately, well, he was 98 years old, but died of corona. Shmuel Ashkenazi, tell you about one of the most interesting people who lived in Jerusalem for many, many decades. And then we're going to finish the section of the book where this section, we'll do that next class. This section of the book, we called it Tikkun Sofrim. Then we move on to Inyanim Shonim, that's basically all sorts of other stuff thrown together, that we didn't have a good place to put them. We'll hear our first question from Rav Chaim David, answer from Rav Chaim David Halevi. Great, great figure. Okay, I see we've gone long enough. Lots of good stuff coming. As I said, this is class 32. I'm estimating 50 classes. Let's say 50 classes. But who knows? I will get Robert sent me something really interesting. I'll get to that next class, Robert, and I'll tell the class exactly what I told you, and I think they'll agree with me and you. But we'll get to that next class. Let me take the questions. Yes, Susanna, Talmid Ot Chachamim, which is what I said. Well, for those who don't, people often say Talmid Ot Chachamah or Talmid Ot Chachamot. This is a construct or a smichut. What it's saying is female students of the wise. It just so happens that today all these great figures, the women that we know who are beginning to write Sfarim, they all trained under men. Give it another 30 years and you could have like my daughter's generation and Rabbi Kelman's daughter, they're training at schools. Well, they could be Talmidot Chachamot because their teachers are the women. So that's all. That's all it is. Michael says,
not fully, by the way, what? Not fully. I can tell you in GPATS, it's still more men than women teaching. But okay, we're on the way. We're getting there.
Okay, but I don't believe that it's as positive that it should be all women. I believe but I also believe that men should be able to learn from women also.
100%.
Okay, Michael says Yellen Moore became, or maybe always was, an extreme leftist. Yes, he was an extreme leftist, as was Eldad. Shamir really, and I said last week, so Gula Cohen was not. She was also. Shamir wasn't so into the ideology. In fact, in 46 to 48, he was out of the country. That was the point I made. Unlike the Irgun, Lechi, I don't look, anyone who could say that if there's a war between the USSR and America, we're going to side with the USSR because we don't like these Western imperialists who are controlling the land of Israel. That is like so backwards. And therefore, so I don't look, unlike the Irgun, which, I mean, who doesn't admire Begin, but to look to these Lechi people, I understood they were nationalists and everything, but they were Marxists and I don't see them at all to be admired, other than the fact that they were dedicated to the land of Israel. But iPad says Israeli labor government to discredit Irgun transformed one of the greatest successes, prison break of a British prison, into a mental hospital. The same population of Pakistan and India, but refugee status was not hereditary. Okay. We know that the labor government, although at the end it seems that Ben Gurion came to a different viewpoint. He was able to tolerate Begin, but at first they could not. They hated them. We know that. And would they acknowledge a massacre in order to make them look bad? Perhaps the Haganah also, the Haganah, they put what was it, Patria or something? They put bombs underneath a boat to prevent it from sinking. To like put it out of commission so the British wouldn't take these refugees and send them to where, Cyprus, wherever they send them to. And they put too much explosives and they killed like 250 people. Hold on, is it the Patria affair? Is that what it is? The Patria disaster. How many, here, let me show you. If you haven't heard this, had the Irgun done this, then here, look up later the Patria disaster. This is 1940. They, what does it say here? 267 people the Haganah killed. Of course, it was an accident. They didn't try to do it on purpose, but there's problems, I guess, on all sides. Read Ephraim Karsh's, Michael says, Palestine betrayed for an exhausting treatment of how the Arabs, their leaders, Jews, and their leaders behaved during the 48-49 war. Felix, email me and I'll connect you to Rav Mazuz's weekly Torah letter. Baruch says, have I learned through the Lubavitcher Tanya as opposed to the original medieval Tanya Rabati with commentaries? How well do you know it? No, I've just read sections of it and I tried. It happens to be a very profound work and very complicated work. And I, there have been times when they've offered to teach to me, and I have to say that I'm not attached to it. I'm not attracted to it. I have not learned, other than certain sections of it, I have not studied it. So I guess that means I'm lacking in like the essence of being a Jew because I haven't learned the Tanya. So okay, but okay. I can email me privately. I give you contact information from Yechiel Goldhaber. Shmuel says, the Rechaim Rapport discuss how and when Chabadniks started to ask the Rebbes about the Kashmir's thing. I'm assuming some Chabad Hasidim always did. Yes, some Chabad Hasidim did always, because we see they were coming to the Baal Tanya, and he was saying, what's going on here? Who ever heard of this thing? Perhaps they just wore the Rebbes down. The Rebbes acquiesced to such demands. I don't know. Rechaim Rapport does not discuss it. I don't know if they wore them down. I think many Rebbes are happy to do that. It gives them a position that they have this power to, I think. Isser says, does Avinar think that the Rambam was not influenced by Aristotle? No. He would acknowledge the Rambam's influence by Aristotle. Rambam tells you, he says, he quotes Aristotle. He tells you that. But the issue with the Abarbanel, you're dealing with like a moral issue of how to view, you know, Torah, the place of a woman in Torah, that sort of thing. That's, I think, that's at least how I see the difference there. Ellen says, wife beating, so why was Leah distressed if it was the normal thing? Well, it could be the normal thing, Ellen, but I think he could still be distressed. Or maybe she assumed she's marrying a nice Jewish boy, and therefore he wouldn't treat her like the Arameans treated her. I don't know. I have to ask. Zachary asks, the notion that Leah was relieved of the hitting by God answering her prayers suggests that the hitting was bad. Yes, it does. But and the Torah is not necessarily saying the hitting is right. And Rabbi Leib is, well, I guess Rabbi Leib's explanation is putting into the context. Maybe you could say in the context it's understandable, but in that circumstance, she didn't need the chinuch or something. So Shmuel likes Rabbi Leib's explanation, but is there any indication that Yaakov would ever beat Rachel? No, he would not beat Rachel. If not, there affects Purim and Yaakov as well, as Rav Aviner suggests, almost as if Yaakov was annoyed with Leah because he has to be married to her. Yes, there's no indication that there isn't. But there is, he does say, I mean, there's another passage where he says he suspected Leah of sexual immorality before their wedding. I think Rabbi Aryeh Leib even quotes there. I mentioned it in the book. These are strange things here. Let's see. Rabbi Aryeh Leib mentions it. I think if you look in, if you look in the Torah, Chaf Tes Lamed Aleph, it says that Yaakov suspected her that. That suspected Leah that she had engaged in sexual immorality. A very strange. I don't understand what's going on. Baruch says, perhaps we should answer along the following lines. Maybe she was a relative child. How old was she then? That's an interesting point. At least from the Torah, we don't know these things, but from the Torah's perspective, yes, he would regard her. What for leaving out midrashic things, even I'll be upshot. What is she, 13, 14? That's true. 12 even. We can say that as with hitting a child, what was meant was not out of anger, as Rambam says, not in a rage, but a controlled, measured way. Yes, and you know, that's the explanation. You know, when we think of Leah as equal, like a romantic partner, the same age, then it's more striking than if we think of it more of a child. But he doesn't, Ravinair doesn't say that. These are all good explanations. In the end, they might not be completely satisfactory, but these are good explanations. And someone emails me privately that when is a husband allowed to hit his wife? If you go in my book, Changing the Immutable, I cite all the passages. And I have to say, though, it's a little bit distressing. Because all these people who claim, well, you know, you do it for chinuch, we all know where that leads to, and it's not, maybe it was taken over from the Muslims. This is the Jewish way, at least not today. Baruch says times have changed, society has changed, the Messias has changed. Leah did not go to Beis Yaakov. She didn't go to Beis Yaakov. She didn't go to Beis Yaakov or Beis. Beth Jacob or anything. Incidentally, what you say is funny because let me get the page. The Torah, he's trying to understand how Leah, remember Leia went out, not Leia, Dina went out dressed inappropriately. I guess this today is not appropriate to say either, blaming the victim. And that led to the whole business with Shlem. And so the Torah connects this to Leia, that maybe it was because of Leia. It's very unusual. And then someone privately mentions that maybe Yaakov saw indications of her father's behavior, that he needed unconventional methods of rebuke. We can give all sorts of explanations. At the end of the day, though, if you're asking me, I don't believe it. I don't believe Yaakov ever did this. What we're all trying to do, though, is explain the tour, his understanding, what he could be thinking. These are all good explanations. Shmuel says some people will be appalled, believe that our descendants will be appalled that we ate meat. You know, when they get this this fake meat, this lab-grown meat, and then we don't have to eat meat, you're right. Then will people walk back and say that we are barbarians? We'll need our rabbis, though, to tell us. Is it meat? Is it basar that can't be with chalav or not? I know there's a big machokas now. If you grow this beef in a lab, what is it? I bet you it's going to end up being machokas some in the end of the day. David says, it's interesting to note that the Maharam, the Rebbe of the Torah's father, writes that any husband who beats his wife should be excommunicated and the court may even cut off his hand. If you look in, you see lots of sources. One of the big ones is the Rambam. The Rambam says if the woman doesn't do what she's told, the kofi nota, you can force her even with a rod. So the Raivan on the spot there says, we never heard of such, and he's writing from, you know, the Ashkenazic clan, we never heard of such a thing, beat your wife. And the commentaries say, though the Rambam's not referring to, most of the commentaries say, he's referring to Beis Din, because he uses the word kofin, that the Rambam, but there's Avram Grossman has written about this, and Mark Shapiro has written about it, so if you don't mind being a little bit distressed that some of our great figures, like Rav Chaim Palach and others, didn't see it as a problem if there was good reason. I think today we realize there's such thing as good reason. Like what they say, that if the husband also curses out the wife's parents, the wife's allowed to beat the husband. And if the wife curses out the husband's parents, the husband beat the wife. But in the real world, we, you know, to hit him. In the real world, we know it's not how it works. It's not even. And so I'm totally comfortable in saying that in earlier times, people didn't see wife beating as the horror that we see it today. And therefore, when you see a rabbi, a woman comes and she wants to get a get because the husband's beating her. And the rabbi says, well, go back, try to make shalom by you. So if things don't work out in another year, I mean, today she goes back, he kill her the next week. So I quoted in one of my blog posts a case mentioned by Chaim Ben Venisti in Turkey where the husband was chasing the wife around with a knife. And they didn't think that Beis Din didn't think that was enough of a reason to order a divorce because the husband promises he'll be good and he won't do it again. I mean, we've learned, I guess, maybe through bad experience, and also we understand things, I think, differently. I don't see anything unquote orthodox about saying that. Someone asked me about the picture of Rabbi Felder. I said, I'd show you it. No, the picture of Rabbi Felder will be in my blog post that comes up tomorrow. But since you ask and you're with me and it's on my screen because I sent it in, I will show you it. I'll explain to you what is being referred to here. We just got one more minute. I think maybe you'll appreciate this, all of you, since I was asked about it right now. Let me show you something. I'm going to show you a screen now of when I was in, I was in Philadelphia. So here is a picture of, can you see it? It's me and Rabbi Aaron Felder. He was the Rav of the Shul in Philadelphia. He was the halachic consultant for the Chaf Kei. He made all the decisions, halachic decisions for the Chaf Kei. He unfortunately passed away. He wasn't that old, 70, I think. And he's a Mechaber Sefer. He's a pulpit rabbi, Mechaber Sefer. So now I want to show you something, though. I mean, this will be in my blog post that appears tomorrow. I want to show you a different picture. When the Yeshiva World News, and also when the Keystone Kosher, that's the Kashrus organization of Philadelphia, wanted to use a picture of Rabbi Felder, the Yeshiva World News after he passed away, and the other one after, it's on their website now. This is the picture they used. It's my picture, but I'm cut off. I'm on the, well, as you look at it, I'm on the left. They cut me out. I get it. It's not a problem. They But that's what I'm referring to, the person who asked me, that they use my, this is now the picture used on the internet of Rabbi Aaron Felder, but yours truly is has been deleted from the picture. Okay, just two more things here. Who's ever sending me private things, mail it to my email, and I'll send you all the contact information of Rabbi Goldhaber. You can hear good talks from Rabbi Goldhaber also on when he comes to America. He'll give a talk in Lakewood, let's say in Yiddish, in YU in English, or another place in Hebrew. You can see some of them on Esrogim. He's an expert on Esrogim. You can see it on YouTube. Baruch says the Baal of Das Kanim speaks of friction between Yaakov and Leah because they're going on with their father's deception. Okay, she and Lavan engage in a terrible sheker. You're right. That's it doesn't say Leah went out dressed inappropriately. It says that the idea is that Dina did. So if you hold on a second, as long as you're here, wait one more minute. I'll read exactly what he says about. You exactly here. Just bear with me for one more minute. I gotta find the papers, which has the exact. Now it's in Balaturim Chavtes Lamed Aleph, and it says as follows. Hold on a second. Chavtes, what question is that? I was looking at it earlier today. I was looking at the Aderis, Eliyahu Dover Rabinetz Teomim. He is shocked. His commentary is in the back. But this is what he says in Lamed Aleph. That what does it say that God saw that Leah was hated and opened up her womb? It says, Lefisha Chashta Yaakov. Yaakov suspected that because she kira atzmo lo, because she gave herself willingly, I guess, without even knowing him, I guess you could say, to had sex with him just on the first date, sort of thing, without even knowing him. So for kach hifkira atzma v'acher, because remember Leah, I mean, she was supposed to be Rachel, and then all of a sudden she just jumps in bed with him. So he says Yaakov suspected that she's, what type of woman is she? She was hifkira atzma lo. So too hifkira atzma v'acher. So too she must have been sexually immoral with others as well. So you look at the Aderis, his commentary. In the back of the edition, I'm reading it right now. Hold on. So he says the Aderis's commentary says as follows. He ties us into Leah. He says, ties us into Dina. Because first he says this is shocking. How could anyone say this? Hold on a second. Chavtes. Hold on. I've got to find you. I'll read you what the Aderis says. Aderis is Rav Kook's father-in-law, or is Eliyahu Dover Rabinetz Teomim. So this is an answer to Baruch's question. So hold on a second. I'll find the problem is it doesn't give you the, it doesn't tell you here in the pages in the back here what parak we are. What parak is this? Chavtes. I just got to, doesn't give you. I just want to find this before we end. I think you'll like this. Okay. We have to find it here. I'm not finding it here. Anyone know what parak are we? I'll get to the, what parak is this? Okay, I want to hold on a second. Just stay with me one more minute here. You're going to want to see this. Why can't I find it? Okay, I got the page now. I think on the base, no, we're in Chavtes. Okay, It's on pages, yes, okay, pages 42 and 43. So the Hedera says this is strange. Where does he? Where did he get this thing? And then he develops the idea here that I don't want to spend too much time here. That I believe it's here. Yeah, where does he? Where could he say this about Leia? I think it's here. I can't see, find it. I'm just going to leave it here. He makes some connection between Dina. Dina went out looking that way and calling attention to herself. So therefore, he connects it to where did, I believe it's here, where does Dina get this from? She must have got it from her mother. And that's, I don't see it here, but I think this is what it is. Okay. No, Baruch, when I say jump into that, I'm not saying, I'm saying that that's what Balatur, that, maybe that's the language I shouldn't use, but he says, Hifkira Atzmalo. What is Hifkira Atzmalo? It means that she just gave to him in more like, she has Geras, like, just like that. So what he's saying is, it's like, he's never met her. They've never had any dealings. He wakes up and who's he's next to? Someone he's never been with and never known. I mean, she, the sister. I mean, it's like, it's a shocking thing. And the language that the Baal HaTorim uses, Hifkira, is, that's the implication. Just, you know, jump into bed. That's that language. And that's, now, of course, we know why this was done, and there's all sorts of reasons, but that's, it's still a shocking thing for the Baal HaTorim to say, the language he uses. Okay, let me just do two more minutes. We can go on. Yes, that's what I mean. Dina's behavior. Okay, so I have to look in Tanchuma. He might quote it. I couldn't find it, and I don't. But he connects the two because he begins by saying, "How is this? How could he say this about Leia?" He's not saying Yaakov is right, but where would Yaakov get this idea? And it could be from that. Yeah, well, we know that you used to be permitted for husbands to rape wives. Yeah, Baruch, I published a photo previously. Yes, I published my photo with Rabbi Felder exactly, but I just saw that I was cut off. So Shmuel says that Dina is called Bas Leah, not Bas Yaakov. But I mean, the whole thing is, I don't get, I have to look at it again, because why would he, I mean, again, that's, it's disparaging Yaakov to say that something happened years later because of Dina, that we see that because then you're implying that Leia did have these bad characteristics. Because if Dina adopted these characteristics, I thought we're supposed to say, even according to that, I don't like this explanation. Is it the Adaris? It might be someone else I saw. Because I think we're supposed to say that this is what Yaakov thought according to the Torah, but Yaakov is wrong. Leah, obviously Leah doesn't have these bad characteristics. But if you're going to connect Leah with Dina, then aren't you concluding that really that there were some of these bad characteristics? Maybe that makes Yaakov look a little better because it shows that his suspicions were not just out of thin air, a crazy thing, but still, you're going to say this about one of the emos, about Leah? Either way you go, it's a problem because if you reflect poorly on Leah, you spare Yaakov because you don't want to say that Yaakov suspected such a terrible thing of Leia. On the other hand, if you make Yaakov look good, then you make Leia look terrible. So my email is shapiro.m2@scranton.edu. Baruch, you say it was a proper wedding. How could it be a proper wedding from the standpoint that we do it? Because you can't get married. The halacha is you have to see someone before you get married. Precisely. When you make a wedding, you have to have kavana who you're going to marry. He didn't have a kavan on Leah. Now, granted, this is before Matan Torah, so it's a different situation. But how could you say it's a proper wedding? He didn't have kavanas for marrying her. And how could she fool him? If you look in the verses, you see the word mishta is used. It's used also by Lot and the daughters. This word is used by not mishta, the root, shata, is used with drinking of wine. So if you read carefully the psukim with Yaakov and Leah, you can see that he was presumably drunk. That word, shata, was used and he didn't know what was going on. But how could that be a proper wedding? Fine, she was afraid she'd be matched up to Esav. Granted, we know all these things, but I'm trying to explain why the Torah says that Yaakov thought Hifkira. Hifkira is a negative term to say about a woman. You don't say that about a woman if you want to respect her. And he's saying that, so it's It's a strange, strange passage. And the Achronim don't know what to make of this. I don't know what to make of it either. I'm just sharing it with you. I'm putting it out there. But I like your explanations, all of them. And I was just trying to explain why the Torah would use that word Hifkira, because Yaakov wakes up and he sees his wife's sister in bed with him. What's incidentally, I'll just end with this one thing. I also think we're a little more sophisticated because in some areas, I found the tshuva where the case is as follows. Someone walks in and a woman is in bed with her husband's brother, literally in bed under the blanket. And the rabbi, the psak was, they claimed that they were just doing it. It was cold outside. And they thought, and the rabbi thought that that was a good, we don't break up a marriage because of that. I don't know. Maybe we're too cynical, but I can't imagine a rabbi today, knowing what goes on in the world, would see something like that. And okay, Barth, you're right. They didn't have modern heating. Okay, Rabbi Kelman, we've gone far.
Well, I don't know, but that's what when Chaim Rappaport was here last in Toronto, we were speaking about that. Our whole view, of course, I mean, not just in the homosexuality, but in all these issues. He said part of the problem is sometimes the Haredi world or doesn't want to admit that sort of we know more than the Chatam Sofer and the Noda Behuda in understanding psychology and things that work there. It's not so simple. I mean, I agree with you. Yes, it's advanced and Rav Kook and all that, but I still think many people do have a problem saying that, our way of thinking, we know more than the previous generation. You know, that strikes the third rail with some people. Anyway.
In certain areas, perhaps, right. We know. Yeah, perhaps.
But you're right. In other areas, I think they accept it. Whatever, we'll see. But anyways, okay.